Timber cutting on federal land in the region is a fraction of what it once was, but it is still going on. We tend to hear about it when there's a legal challenge. And there is such a challenge to the second show timber sale proposed for Bureau of Land Management land northeast of Springfield. Cascadia Wildlands and Oregon Wild filed suit against the sale in federal court in Eugene, citing a variety of issues. Nick Cady is the legal director at Cascadia Wildlands and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Nick, welcome to the program again.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So start off with where the second show timber sale is.
Right, so it's just northeast of Eugene, Springfield, in Lane County, Oregon. It's a popular recreation area known as Shotgun Creek, so it's right around that. It's actually right in, right above Eugene's domestic water supply.
And this is near Marcola?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, and how far from Eugene, approximately?
We drove out there not too long ago. It took about 15 minutes, I think.
Okay, so not really not that far outside the Eugene,
right.
Springfield metro area at all.
Yeah.
What's the history of the land there, Nick? Has it been cut before?
Yes. This is all second growth. This area has gone through, the whole watershed is pretty hammered. It's been through a lot of logging in the past and a lot of road construction. And so this is all kind of a second growth area. It was kind of area that was logged about 90 years ago.
And I know timber sales get funny names like fires, but do we know why it's called Second Show?
You know, we're not sure. We do run across a lot of funny timber sale names, but we're not sure why Second Show is the name here.
So let's parse the language, because the release that you and Oregon Wild put out jointly indicate that this is 259 acres of clear cutting. Does that mean that all 259 acres will be clear cut?
Yes. So,
really?
Normally these sales involve like a lot of thinning and some only a certain degree is clear cutting, but this is the largest we've seen in I think 20 years in Lane County. It could be all of Western Oregon. We were just able to kind of double check in Lane County, but 259 acres, and they're only leaving potentially 0 to 2 trees per acre, and that's kind of averaged across the whole project area. So this is real clear cutting. This is kind of private lands clear cutting on public lands.
All right, I was going to ask you about the difference, because my recollection is that in the last couple of decades there's been heavier clear cutting on private land, and it seems like more selective cutting on public land.
Yes, so this is kind of it's not a pilot project, but they're implementing the kind of this new style of clear cutting that they want to practice across public lands, and it eliminates kind of the retention requirements that normally dominate on public lands logging. So normally you have to retain, 8 to 14 trees per acre, and you have to leave buffers around kind of different ecological values, unique things in the forest stand. But this project doesn't retain any of those, and just clear cuts these kind of patches that are all kind of connected, and it leaves kind of a thin strip of trees between each clear cut area to avoid violating the Oregon Forest Practices Act, which requires, I think, a large clear cut you can have is 40 contiguous acres.
All right. So they're going to the 40 and then have little patches of stuff between them?
Yes, exactly.
All right. How much, so not much timber left standing there. Any idea what the board footage is like that's supposed to come out of this sale?
That is a great question. I don't know that offhand.
And what kind of tree species are we talking about here?
These are predominantly Douglas fir forests. It does have a nice amount of hardwood diversity in there, but these are kind of 80-year-old, Douglas fir predominantly forests. There's probably a lot of hardwood species in there as well, but like madrone and maple.
You mentioned elimination of some of the standing retention requirements. What's the general thinking that you're aware of as far as what this is supposed to do for the land?
Yeah, as initially proposed, this project was unique in that it really got rid of the retention requirements. They initially kind of theorized that under the Northwest Forest Plan, they have to retain, 8 to 14 trees per acre. And so to get around that requirement, they said that, the areas were not logging like just over the rivers. If we average that out across the whole project, that meets our retention requirements. And so that's something that we kind of initially complained about in our comments, and they rectified that later on, but still they only changed it to 2 trees per acre, that they're 0 to 2, so we're not sure really what that's going to look like on the ground. I think it's kind of up to the purchaser as to what actually gets left on the ground, but the result of this is that it has massive implications for soil quality and water quality, and this is a very problematic watershed. The Mohawk watershed has gone through intense logging and road construction in the past and is already kind of classified in terms of, again, this is in relation to salmon, but is not properly functioning. And so it's kind of a problematic watershed to begin with, and this kind of heavy logging kind of increases a number of different risk factors that have implications for, you know, our drinking water here.
Nick Cady is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the legal director at Cascadia Wildlands, which, with Oregon Wild, has filed suit in federal court against the Bureau of Land Management for the second show timber sale in the Marcola area up Shotgun Creek. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions or comments about this or timber process generally as viewed from the Cascadia Wildlands side. 800-838-3760 around the region, 800-838-3760, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. You were talking about the Mohawk River watershed, which I see is called a fifth field watershed in your suit. What does that mean?
A fifth field watershed is just a scale, so it's just a size. So generally, they're about 100,000 acres, and you know, there's a multiple. Kind of the whole Western Oregon is divided up into various fifth field watersheds. It's how they. It's kind of a unit of analysis.
Okay. Now the. You and Oregon Wild did file administrative appeals with BLM, I'm thinking, before you got to court?
Right. Yeah, this is kind of an interesting part of this whole suit. Yes, we did file a series. You're required to file a series of kind of administrative appeals and comments along the way to give the BLM an opportunity to respond to your concerns. So this project, you know, just outside of Eugene, just outside of Springfield, it got massive amounts of public comment. I think they said over 700 public comments. Which is unheard of. Normally there's like four. But I think this one had really grabbed the public's attention, and they did a series of public field trips that we attended. So after kind of initially crafting the project and going through the scoping period, once they come out with the decision, you have 15 days to protest the sale. And so we submitted a protest, you know, 7 days. We threw it, you know, certified mail in the Eugene post office here to go over to the Springfield post office where Eugene BLM's office and P.O. Box are. And they claim to have not received our protest and kind of blamed the post office for failing to deliver them a notice, or we're not exactly sure what that looks like, but in effect they denied all this public comment and they blamed it on the post office. It's something it's kind of unheard of. We weren't sure how to respond.
Is there some requirement that this has to be delivered through the U.S. mail? I mean, you can't just hand deliver to the BLM office or something?
You could run over there and hand deliver it, but there's a tight deadline for public comment. You know, it's 15 days. And so we put our protest in. And you can't, they don't allow email, so you cannot email it for whatever reason. And so that's why you have to go through the rigmarole of putting it in the certified mail. It's like a requirement, and the certified mail documents like when you put it in the mail and when they're supposed to receive it. And so we kind of put it in the mail 6 days beforehand and figured everything was fine. And kind of 10 days after the deadline, we get a call, or we call into the BLM office because we hadn't heard anything from them about the protest. And they were like, oh, we haven't received it yet. And apparently they kind of lost the little notices that said that the piece of certified mail is waiting for them in the post office. I mean, this is something we'll kind of hash out, but it kind of all stems from the BLM's refusal to accept email, which is a little archaic.
Well, I was going to ask about federal agencies and electronic communications and electronic comments. I know, having to work with the FCC in our line of work, that just almost all the paperwork is done online now.
Right. And that's, you know, it's something, so federal agencies have been trying to avoid the practice where they have been getting tons of public comment where people are able to just like click, you know, comment now on a website, mm-hmm. you know, and it sends them some preform generated comment on some aspect of something. And so a lot of projects, a lot of government agencies are kind of tailoring the comment process to make it more difficult to comment. I mean, the problem is, you know, these are supposed to be open public processes. You're supposed to be able to easily weigh in and let them know what you think one way or the other on what the agency is doing. And the BLM historically is very notorious at making it difficult to comment. You have to go through three different appeals processes to even have a chance at getting public review of a project. It's a lot of hoops to jump through.
When did the comment period open and close, this 15 days?
So the 15 days opened at some point in August of last year, and it closed on, I believe, September 6th. And so we put kind of our stuff in the mail August 28th, and so that was when it was postmarked. And, you know, they have a lot of regulations on when the regulations that BLM are operating under say, you know, the protest isn't effective until it's received. So it has to be received by the deadline. But they have a number of regulations being like, if it's postmarked before the date that they actually receive it, then it's considered timely. And, you know, for some reason, I think they were just trying to sneak one through. And that's kind of why we're having... That's part of the debate here.
So there is some variability here. I mean, they do have their own hard deadline, but if they receive it after that deadline, but it's postmarked before the deadline, they would accept it?
Right, right. Their regulations say they would.
All right. Again, we're talking to Nick Cady, who's legal director at Cascadia Wildlands, about a challenge to the BLM in court over the second show timber sale northeast of Eugene Springfield. So what do you want the court to do?
So, you know, this the whole protest thing we've been discussing is a bit of a sideshow. The real issue here is that this second show timber sale, which has, you know, extreme levels of effects, you know, this is the largest clear cut we've seen in 20 years. Initially, this project was proposed in conjunction with about 1,500 acres of fairly heavy commercial thinning and about 26 miles of road construction. So, you know, commercial logging and road construction in a watershed affect a number of variables that weigh heavily on water quality in an area. And this is, you know, a watershed that's, as I said, runs right into Eugene's water supply takeout on the Mackenzie. And so it was super concerning to us that these two heavy timber sales were planned at the same time in the same area. And the BLM eventually bifurcated the two sales, like process-wise. They separated out the clear cutting from the 1,500 acres of thinning, but then failed, you know, under federal environmental law, government agencies need to weigh the additive impacts of projects that are occurring, you know, at the same time and in the same area. And these sales are kind of right next to each other. Parts of it are adjacent. They're in the same watershed.
So it can't just stand on their own merits if there's one in the neighborhood.
Right, right. They can't view things in isolation when they're going to have an additive impact on the environment. They need to add that impact. Somewhere along the way, they need to analyze it. And this sale, they didn't analyze the additive impact. You know, in either project, they kind of viewed them in isolation of each other, despite the fact that they're right next to each other and happening at the same time.
So some of the claims in the lawsuit obviously made under NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, which is what requires environmental impact statements and all of that. But you're also got some claims under APA. What is that? What's your case there?
So claims brought under NEPA are actually brought under the Administrative Procedures Act, which is known as the APA. That's how you kind of challenge any government agency action. And it's the burden on conservation groups, or, you know, when the industry sues the government, it's the same burden on them. They have to prove that the government's actions were arbitrary and capricious. That's kind of this universal standard. And it's a very hard standard to meet, because you kind of have to show that the government agency had no reasonable basis in what they were doing. And so we think here, you know, by failing, you know, the NEPA is very clear in that, you know, these agencies need to consider, you know, additive cumulative impacts from timber sales in the same area. And, you know, we think they just flatly failed to do that. And so that would be an example of something being arbitrary and capricious if they just completely neglected to do something that they're required to do.
So given that the comment period has closed already and did close back in September, and your lawsuit is fairly recent, I mean, where do things stand as far as timber put out for bid or any of that stuff?
Well, yes, the timber has been put out. It's been auctioned. The sales have been bought by, I believe, Seneca Jones. And we did get a letter from the BLM saying that the purchaser was planning to implement the project or begin implementing the project this winter. And we're not sure if that just means preliminary road construction or if they're actually going to start felling trees, but that it could begin at any time.
And are you asking for injunctive relief to stop the process before it gets going?
Not yet, but that's something we're considering.
And so, Nick, what's the usual pathway here? I mean, one's between the time of filing and getting a hearing, and that usually is the next step, isn't it?
Right. So if we were to request some sort of preliminary injunctive relief, if we found out that there was cutting happening in the timber sale area, we would immediately file a temporary restraining order, which would they have kind of 10 days to respond to, and it kind of gives you a stay of 10 days. But briefing in that instance and hearings would occur very quickly and probably over the phone due to just everyone's availability. But if we were to wait, if there is no implementation of the sale, we kind of can afford to wait and hear and talk to DOJ lawyers and attempt to work out so there isn't all this extra court time.
Is there often a hope that this will be withdrawn or that they'll go back to some sort of administrative process and not want to go through the court process? Is that what you're seeking here?
Yes. Yeah. Ideally, this would go back into the analysis and they would look and, you know, weigh the different harms to the watershed and maybe cut out a good deal of these logging and road construction.
I'm sure there are people who are thinking, well, you know, what's okay with you guys at Cascadia Wildlands and Oregon Wild? What would you accept in the way of timber cutting? Is there any timber cutting that you do find acceptable?
Right. These are kind of issues that get raised a lot. And we frequently get accused of being organizations that, you know, don't tolerate any logging whatsoever. And the fact is, this is like a major business in Oregon. You know, we are, you know, timber capital of the world. It's something, it's a natural resource that we produce. And, you know, generally, as organizationally, we're our primary concern is all public land. So we're not dealing at all with private lands logging. But on federal lands, you have a ton of these plantations. You know, they're legacies of all this clear cutting that occurred throughout Oregon on public land in the past. And what we kind of prefer these government agencies to do is focus on kind of commercial thinning where they can pull out tons of volume, and they have been doing it for, you know, 20 years now, and it's very commercially viable. They make a ton of money, provides jobs, and it's restorative. You know, these dense, thick tree plantations are not only crazy fire hazards because they burn hotter, because they have all this additional woody material. So they're very thickly, they've been very thickly replanted and grown up together, but they provide almost zero ecological value.
So thinning is the way to go. Nick Cady is the legal director of Cascadia Wildlands, which has filed suit in federal court in Eugene with Oregon Wild against the second show timber sale that the BLM proposes northeast of Eugene in the Marcola area. Nick, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much.